Need a reason to smile? Comfort Dental has you covered with new patient exams, including x-rays, for just $19. That's right, only $19 to get started on a healthier, brighter smile. With convenient locations, flexible hours, including evenings and Saturdays, and a team that truly cares, Comfort Dental makes dental care easy and affordable. No gimmicks, no stress, just quality care when you need it. Get comfortable with Comfort Dental. Call or visit ComfortDental.com today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. We'll chat China. Is UKHE too close to and too reliant on the superpower? There's new stats out on mental health and graduate jobs and vaccine uptake amongst students, and more evidence on the digital divide. It's all coming up.
There'll be other limiting factors which haven't been impacted by the pandemic, the diversity of staff, the curriculum, and lots of other things. But tackling these awarding gaps, you know, there's no silver bullet here. One of the factors may have been dealt with.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us understand what's going on in higher education this week. As usual, we have two fabulous guests. In windy Gravesend, Selena Bolingbroke is a consulting fellow for the Halpin Partnership. Selena, your highlight of the week?
I think the highlight of the week has possibly got to be the bumper release of stats from the Office of National Statistics.
Well, we'll come to that. And in Beckenham in South East London, Amitai Doku is a consultant with the Nous Group. Amitai, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, I'm reading Ian Dale's compilation of essays on all the prime ministers, which is a fascinating read. And just this week got to the chapter on Gladstone, when it all kicked off in Liverpool with the renaming, or the controversy around the renaming of the of Gladstone Halls, student accommodation, because of his links to the slave trade. So I thought that was an interesting coincidence, meaning that I was slightly more informed about him than I otherwise would have been.
Fantastic stuff. So, good. We start this week with China. A report led by former Universities Minister Joe Johnson warns of the poorly understood risks of increasingly close collaboration between UK universities and China. Amitai, tell us more.
Well, obviously, Joe Johnson's been keeping himself busy after his various stints in as Universities Minister. But a really interesting and pretty comprehensive report looking at the relationship that the UK higher education has with China. And yeah, the report highlights a couple of areas. It focuses on the role that China is playing globally in research and development, you know, showing that it's set to overtake the US, or forecasting that it's set to overtake the US as the world's biggest spender on research and development, as well as the UK's most significant research partner. And there's a really interesting sort of comparison looking at the fact that in 2019, the UK collaborated with China on about 16,000, over 16,000 research papers, which is from, you know, about 100 papers in the early 1990s. But it's pretty punchy report, you know, it's pretty critical. I think sort of it is pretty critical about the current approach. It sort of gives the impression that the view of those writing the report is that the UK really needs to up its game when it, in terms of understanding the policy. It needs to start to be more robust against China. It describes China as an authoritarian dictatorship that shows little desire to transform itself into Western-style liberal democracy, whilst understanding the sort of reality of the situation, that the relationship between UKHE and China is fairly intertwined. So lots of interesting policy recommendations there, proposing to increase the QR funding so that it's not reliant on international students, focusing on the fact that there are lots of international students from China as well. And really saying that, lots of requests for UKRI to be more robust in this, to do more auditing, to do more checking existing research partnerships. One kind of takeaway for me is that I think there needs to be a bit more primary research on this. But very interesting report.
Selena, that line that Amitai pulls out about, the authoritarian dictatorship that shows little desire to transform itself into Western-style liberal democracy kind of is what it is, isn't it? But Joe Johnson then says that requires a carefully calibrated policy mix. Is your sense that what's in here would address the concern, or, what's your view on the kind of solutions that have been proposed here?
I think that there's obviously a certain amount of posturing that sits behind the scenes in the kind of premise around what China is and what China is trying to do in terms of its links with UK higher education, which have been built up over a long period of time, but also built up at a time where it has been extending its international links, across the States, Australia, various other countries. And I think that the solutions that are proposed in here probably aren't going to unwind what has already been laid out extensively in terms of relationships between UK universities and Chinese universities, and indeed a sense of appetite from Chinese students to study overseas, and increasingly for UK students to take up the opportunity for some experience of transnational education in China. So I think it's helpful to point out, and to, as the report says, for us to be aware of the extensiveness of the links, the depth of the links, and the volume of activity. But I would think where we are right now, and certainly from an individual institution's perspective, the solutions that are proposed here are not going to be effective at rolling back.
Yeah, I'm going to say, one of the things I was talking to someone about the other day is what even would rolling back look like? Even if universities needed the money less, what is it that they would do to discourage students from China coming? We can't have people discriminating against students from China, surely, in what are supposed to be, officially and in theory, standards for admission that, are just slightly adapted for each country.
I think there are sort of two things there. The first thing, which, and admittedly, I haven't read the report in the most detail to potentially qualify this, but the overall impression I get from the initial review that I've done is that there isn't enough focus on the role that US foreign policy plays in all of this either. So going back to what you highlighted about that carefully calibrated policy response, if the ratcheting up of US foreign policy towards China increases as China's influence in the world grows, are we going to end up in a situation where effectively we are going to have to start picking sides? And in that case, it feels like US foreign policy is going to drive a lot of what we end up doing in that first instance, particularly given that we're outside of the EU now, and that focus on alliances is even more important. But interestingly, the report doesn't really say that. It talks about diversifying international student recruitment, but it says that from a point of view of saying, because we don't want to become too over-reliant on it, because we actually think it's going to drop off over time, potentially, because of the rise of universities in China. So there isn't really very much in there which is saying we need to stop Chinese students from coming to the UK, but there's something around, it is, as Chinese institutions grow and as the government potentially starts to incentivize more students to stay and study domestically, that is a risk for UK universities. Now, we're less exposed like places like Australia, still, the reports are saying UK universities need to prepare for that. But even in their own forecast, it doesn't suggest that in the next couple of years we're going to see a massive drop off or anything like that. So, as Selena pointed out, the appetite from UK from Chinese students and their families to get that higher education is still very, very strong.
Selina, is you know, at the risk of being accused of being a sort of, you know, Britain-hating, you know, wokenista or whatever, you know, Piers Morgan would call me this week, is the danger here that, you know, we start off trying to spread soft power by, you know, having people come to the country, then we start to rely on the money, and now all of a sudden we're worried that people are learning about the things we're teaching and taking them back to their country? I mean,
there's a bit of manufactured anxiety around some of this. So, you know, potentially there are different types of risk. One is, if you like, a business risk, which is about some universities in the UK, their reliance on international students and Chinese students in particular. But that's very few institutions in reality. And of course, all organisations, including universities, want to have a kind of broad base in terms of where they get their income from, because that naturally de-risks it. I think the political risk, absolutely, you know, from a higher education perspective about, you know, the fundamental core principles of what higher education is about, it is about expanding knowledge networks. It is about lifting up the power of knowledge and expertise and sharing that. I think that, you know, for many, many years, I sort of go back into, the 1990s, considering early international partnerships in countries that we didn't have, as you know, a lot of experience in doing business with, and who had fundamentally different and not democratic regimes to what we had. And I can remember a lot of the debate that we had within the universities that I worked in at the time were about, we have a set of policies, a set of regulations, a set of principles about what we are trying to do. And as long as we can continue to uphold our own sense of what is the right way to deliver a higher education, then that is what is fundamentally important to us.
One of the things which I think the report sort of does implicitly, but I think explicitly, you've really got to separate out. Chinese students are very different to Chinese institutions, are very different to the Chinese government. Now, there's obviously a clear relationship between all those players, and we know that you know, some of the significant issues that the report is right to highlight around encroaching on freedom of expression and the rest of it. But in a sense, I would have liked to have seen that really tackled in isolation, because I don't always think it's helpful to equate, for example, the number of Chinese students coming to the UK with anything to do with, you know, encroaching on free speech. You know, the vast majority, well, not necessarily all of them, but you know, a lot of them are undergraduate students who are doing, you know, 3 or 4 year courses, who aren't doing any research, and then they go back and they get jobs. So it's really important to separate that out. I think it is right to draw attention to the broader geopolitical challenges and the way in which those research partnerships could be leveraged by the government, in the way that lots of governments in history have done so. So I'm not saying the UK is in any way immune from that. I think that's right and that's fine. It's important to bear that in mind. We know that there's been challenges with things called reputation laundering and the rest of it. That certainly needs to be looked at, and robust things need to be put in place. But that shouldn't be conflated with the number of Chinese students coming in. And arguably, depending on what's actually being researched, shouldn't really be conflated with the actual research that's, you know, taking place. You know, if it's around security, then potentially. If it's around addressing social challenges and social issues, maybe not. So I think there needs to be a bit more of a nuance in this conversation to make sure that we aren't just casting everybody and anybody who comes from China as a sort of threat. And I think that would be a real issue in the debate moving forward.
Because Selina, Amitai's right, isn't he? That there is a danger here that reports like this add to the kind of chorus in the background that leads to, you know, home students or, you know, home-based academics having this kind of level of, you know, unconscious suspicion around, you know, Chinese students or visiting Chinese academics and so on. And we already know there's an integration problem on campus in many universities.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the tone of, the press coverage around this would back that up, regardless of whether it's a supposed kind of right-wing press view or a left-wing press view. And I think it's also within the context of what we knew to be a fair amount of East Asian racism, you know, that dates back, well, further than the pandemic, but certainly with higher profile last year. So I think there does need to as Amitai says, you know, the Chinese student is there are many of them who, with all different points of view, you know what I mean? So this conflation between the Chinese student, the average Chinese student who we meet on campus, with the authoritarian Chinese government is false.
Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Jan MacArthur, Senior Lecturer in Education and Social Justice at Lancaster University. My article in Wonky challenges higher education to think more radically about assessment reform. Instead of using COVID to rethink why we use exams and our beliefs about the purposes of assessment, many universities have simply pursued technocratic solutions that reproduce the trusted orthodoxy of the time-limited, unseen exam as closely as possible. Instead, assessment should begin by thinking about the student as a whole person. What are their needs and aspirations? How will assessment help these to be achieved and recognised? Authentic assessment is good, but not if we conflate the real world with simply the world of work. We need forms of assessment that will nurture the creative, questioning and nuanced forms of knowledge in our graduates that are essential for the challenges ahead. Assessment shapes how and what students learn. So we must think beyond the time-old practices and harness assessment to help address social and economic problems. The changes required are profound. Not least, we must recognise that the social fetishisation of grades is individually damaging and socially unproductive.
Now, it says here it's been a bumper week for fans of the Office for National Statistics. I don't know. Selena, what did we learn this week?
It has been a bumper week indeed, Jim. So on Monday, the ONS published an analysis of graduate labour market outcomes. And that covers the first three quarters of 2020. So quite an exceptional year, we know that. And I think the headlines won't be unsurprising to people. So the report shows that recent graduates have struggled to find work during the pandemic, with a record 12% of recent graduates unable to find work during the third quarter of 2020. And I should say, DK's done a great article on the Wonky website about this data release. But it does say that graduates of all ages still are more likely to be in work and are increasingly likely to be found in highly skilled roles. Although there is some evidence that some graduates have taken less skilled work during the pandemic. And I think, you know, all of us that know graduates will know that in terms of their experience over the last few months. I think what's important to remember when we look at these kind of data releases is that, first of all, graduates, however bad they're doing much better than their peers who are non-graduates. And, you know, non-graduate young people have suffered most, without a doubt, in this pandemic, in economic and employment terms, and indeed in social terms. But I'm going to come on to that in a moment. I think the other thing that if you're sitting in a university career service, employment service, that you probably need to be thinking about, particularly in terms of some of the local and regional initiatives to boost employment opportunities, is that where you have that underemployment of graduates, quite often that can lead to unemployment for other groups. So it's you know, not surprising that graduates are both more occupationally and geographically mobile than other adults in the population, and quite often other young people in the population. So the idea of the kind of graduate premium in the employment market is sustained. Of course, those headlines are going to mask subject differences. So we know that certain industries, that particularly those industries that might have provided the sort of first step on the ladder for many graduates. And quite often that can be retail, that can be hospitality. You know, people are coming out of university just desperate to earn some cash to sustain themselves, perhaps, before moving into, you know, a desired graduate job. They won't have been there this summer. And there are other industries, creative cultural industries have, you know, taken a real disproportionate hit for for young entrants more generally. Also, quite often, because a lot of the graduates who are trying to make a living in those industries go down the freelance route, sometimes not through choice, just through necessity. But we are blessed because it isn't just graduate employment that we've got a data release on this week. There is also a subset of some ONS data work on well, it's called the Student COVID-19 Insight Survey, and it looks at their behaviours, their plans, their opinions, and most importantly, student well-being. And it's for English higher education students, and it's been taken at periodic intervals during the pandemic. So this was well covered in the press, and the headline that was sort of really used by most press was that a quarter of students reported feeling lonely, often or always, and that is at a rate more than three times that of the general population. In the same period between February and March this year, almost two-thirds of students indicated that their mental health had worsened since the start of the autumn term in 2020. So I think there's just a couple of things that I want to pull out, because I think, again, you know, the headlines aren't surprising. But I think that one of the things we always need to remember when we look at ONS stats around students and graduates is to also look at the data around from the general population at young people more generally. And there is not exactly the same survey, but a very similar survey that ONS have released that looks at the general population. And I had a quick dig into that. And if you look at young people between 18 and 24 compared to other adult age groups, they too are more unhappy than average. There's also some interesting data cuts in terms of region. So people who live in London and Wales have been more unhappy during the pandemic. And in fact, if you're a man over 70 living in the East Midlands, I mean, you're positively laughing compared to everybody else.
Yes, of course, we need greater funding. But actually, what's more useful is funding in trying to find sustainable solutions for this stuff, so that every time there's a crisis, we don't say, well, we just need more money. You know, where is a longer term conversation? Where do we grapple with those really challenging things of, you know, where's the... You know, which bit of the support is a responsibility for the university? Which bit is the support is a responsibility for the NHS? And arguably, and this may be drifting away a bit, but arguably the reforms that are coming into the NHS, which are focused a lot more around place rather than just looking at individual trusts and as sort of providers of services, could be something that universities certainly more broadly could be partnering on, but potentially when it comes to student support and student mental health, there's an opportunity there as there's reorganization in the NHS for universities to get involved in that. But I think just calling for greater funding provider by provider isn't really going to necessarily probably either result in very much funding or necessarily be the solution that we need. But I think more broadly, one of the, you know, just thinking about the budget last week as a sort of precursor to this data coming out, you know, the data isn't on employment and isn't really sort of surprising. It's what you'd expect given what's happened. What's concerning is that the solutions don't appear to be particularly well thought through, or indeed, as I was saying earlier, or particularly joined up. So you've got to be bringing employers, the skills agenda, universities, colleges, skills agenda and skills gaps, and then that broader thing of where is employment even going in the longer term, and how does that inform, you know, what's being taught? You've got to bring that all together to both tackle the immediate challenges, but also the long-term challenges. And I just do not see that happening anywhere. You know, the most we saw from the budget is we've got some more work coaches, but even that's not really geared towards the demographics that we're talking about today. So, you know, some real, real challenges, but I think a huge opportunity.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's academic registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of 8 years.
The first European university, the thing that we think of, now there's a debate about whether African and Middle Eastern cities had things that are effectively universities, and they seriously antedate the European university. But the thing that we think of as a university, universitas, is a guild. And it's first set up as a guild by a bunch of law students who've gathered in Bologna. And their problems are issues with the townspeople who keep trying to fleece them, but also issues with the people who are teaching them. So the university, the guild of people in that city, is formed of the students. So it's a guild of the students. Universitas means the collection of everybody in a place doing something. You can have a universitas of cobblers. In this case, it's a universitas of students. So they set up a guild, and it has a set of rules. And the rules are relatively straightforward for the students. There's a set of rules about not fighting each other, but apart from that, it's very limited in terms of the student regulations. All the regulations are all about the staff. So they're all about the staff are supposed to turn up on time. There's some very strict rules about they have to start when they have to start the lectures and when they have to finish them. And if the lecture's going on for too long, the students are obliged to get up and go to show their displeasure at the at this kind of tardiness. There's clear rules about following the curriculum, not skimping on the hard bits, making sure the students understand the curriculum properly, and not getting into any of the dubious, teaching the coasting bits. So they've got to make that clear. Their staff have to swear allegiance to the student's rector. They aren't allowed out of town without asking permission to the students. They have to get permission to do that. And obviously, the way the staff get paid is through the student fee. So, yeah, there's a clear economical link, but the students have all these rules. When you get to Northern European universities, they're more theological in focus, and so it's the bishop's chancellor who takes charge of organisation, and these become master's universities. So Northern European universities are master's and scholars universities, whereas a group of the Italian and Southern European universities are student universities. So you get this dichotomy of organisational structures. We don't get a proper students' university in England, certainly. There's a sense of hybridness in the Scots universities with their rector, but it's nothing of the same kind of power that we get from Southern Europe.
Now, next up, it's been DigiFest this week, and to mark the occasion, JISC has published this year's Digital Experience Insights Survey. Amate, what did we learn?
Similar to what we've sort of been discussing today, a really timely survey of over 21,000 students, and some really interesting findings. We find that 36% agreed that they were given a chance to be involved in online learning, and that potentially, I think we would all agree, could be a lot more. But despite this, we've got 66% of students saying that they had a really positive experience with their online learning, and just over half praising the design of online learning materials. I think there's a really interesting story here. This is a story of the higher education sector making a transition faster than potentially it ever has in its history, in terms of the delivery of its education. I think probably unparalleled in history in such a short space of time. And overall, if these stats are to be to be believed, overall fairly successful, given the speed at which this change has happened from the point of view from the students. However, I think the if you were to take it as a major experiment or a very quick pilot, as it were, these results wouldn't be too bad. The problem is that transition has happened, and the expectations will only grow for this stuff. And I think satisfaction potentially could start to decline very quickly if longer term improvements aren't made. There's a really big question now about where does the sector go with this? And lots of the conversation we've been having recently show that there are lots of very, as you would expect, lots of very different perspectives on where universities should go. Some people see this as an opportunity for a complete transformation in the delivery of teaching and learning, much more online delivery, a sort of Netflixization of the lecture series, a real focus on that online delivery. Others saying, actually, no, students really want to be on campus, and the online delivery will be there, but it'll only be a part of what we do. It won't be, you know, people want face-to-face learning, particularly in the whole conversation around fees. And then there are quite a lot of institutions who are sort of in this slightly amorphous middle bit where they're saying, you know, we can't go back. Online delivery is here to stay. We want that to be a sort of hybrid experience with students on campus, but we're not entirely sure.
Well, see, if this is easy, I'm saying. People want to be on campus staring at their phone.
Well, precisely. But I think it also, we've got to be really careful about this, though, because to some extent, everybody going online, and, you know, obviously we've got students still on campus, but by and large, if it's not face-to-face teaching, you're in your room on your laptop, accessing resources and lectures and the rest of it.
I used to worry about students not being able to afford to join societies or to buy textbooks, but there's more evidence of a digital divide in here, isn't there? That should, you know, worry us.
Yeah, it should worry us. It absolutely should. I think that, you know, this is the kind of thing that it's very difficult to come up with sustainable university solutions to. It seems to me that there is an increasing requirement that there needs to be national solutions for people, because, I've been a school governor for a long time, and most recently in Tower Hamlets. But, you know, it was a very, very significant divide in the early months of the pandemic, and it was something that the school that I was working with put a huge amount of effort into changing. But, you know, in a way, I think that the digital engagement is something that can be sold. It takes money, it takes commitment, it takes a framework, but you can see many ways. And I think, you know, as well as government, I think technology companies have got a huge incentive to think about, you know, very big picture solutions to some of these problems. I think what is harder to change, and I think universities do have a role here, is thinking about how the nature of teaching and the relationship between student and teacher needs to change. I would contend that there is a much greater need for more of a coaching style to be able to support students with online learning, because, you know, the information transmission, we're not reliant on a teacher for that anymore in a lot of ways. But it is about supporting how students engage with that material, how they question that material, how they bring their own critical challenge to it. And I think when it's done well, it can be a much more positive experience than sitting, you know, in a large lecture theatre or in a seminar with 30 people in it, which, you know, unless you're very confident, you it's very rare that you're going to be able to kind of expose your own individual learning questions. So I think there's lots and lots of potential that comes from reports like this. I think the other thing we need to remember in universities is that in many ways, schools have dealt with this transition incredibly well, and I have no sense that they will be rolling back. So I think yet again we are going to have, in, you know, 2 or 3 years, 4 years time, a set of young people coming into universities that will have ever higher expectations, not just about the quality of digital learning in terms of, you know, platforms and access and content, but actually about the skills of teachers in terms of helping students to learn.
Now, just before we go, this is hot off the press because we record at 9:30 on a Thursday, and people keep there's a thing about releasing higher education stats at 9:30 on a Thursday. But while we've been recording, two of the Office for Students key performance measures have been updated to reflect 2019-2020. And there are two big headlines here. So first of all, the gap in degree outcomes, so good honours, firsts or two ones, between disabled students and non-disabled students has narrowed really quite rapidly from 2.5 percentage points to 1.3 percentage points. And also, fairly dramatically, the gap in degree outcomes between white students and black students has gone gone from 22.1 percentage points to 18.3 percentage points. So two quite significant national attainment gaps, significantly narrowed at the end of last academic year, when we know from a few weeks ago there was also a significant wedge of grade inflation. So Amate, hot take time. What could be going on here?
Well, look, I think one of the things which is sort of well documented is the both the no detriment policies and the difference in the way in which assessments have been the difference in the types of assessments that we've had over this last year. So those two things could have had a significant role in contributing to that. I think the challenge will be how do you replicate that in further in years which hopefully will quote unquote go back to normal. It's going to be a really complex piece of work, combining both, understanding of the different policies that different institutions took. This is the other thing. Lots of institutions did completely different things, even though this appears to be a narrowing across the board. So we've got to have a look at that. We've got to understand from students qualitatively, what was different about this year that might have contributed to this. I think there's a real opportunity. Whether there's the appetite to do that hard work, I don't know.
Selena, this is really difficult now for OFS, isn't it? Because, either it says crack down on grade inflation that you had temporarily, and the obvious way to do that would be to reverse all of this progress on disabled students and black students, or what exactly? I mean, it's really difficult now, isn't it? Does OFS focus on the narrowing of these gaps as long as people can prove they've kept their standards by doing different assessment, or does OFS focus on the grade inflation? This is a toughie.
Well, I think what I think they should do, which is to focus on the material issues, and the material issues is the awarding gaps. And I think it really is quite significant, because the pace of change is something that, as Amate says, that institutions will surely want to really dig into their own data to see what has happened and, most important, why. But, just look back at the 9 years before this year's data release. So over those 9 years, the awarding gap between black and white students, it was 27.1%. And in 9 years, it fell to 22%, which is already is still a very significant gap between black and white students. But in 9 years, it only narrowed by 5%. And then in 1 year, it's fallen from 22% to 18%. So in 1 year, it's fallen by 4%. So, where there's a will, there's a way. And this is something that makes, we go back to what we were talking about earlier in the show about employment prospects. This is something that has material impact for our students, our graduates, and indeed an impact on our institutions. So I very much hope that OFS do focus on trying to support institutions to unpick why we've had this great news. It is good news, and doesn't fall back into the concerns that were essentially raised by politicians.
There's never been a more important moment, has there, than to try to use students and talk to students about why these stats have narrowed, rather than just trying to, head scratch over the stats. It's working out what leads to stats like this that's important, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is why, as I was saying, you really need, rather than just sort of stepping back and saying, great, we've done a good job, really, questioning and trying to get to the root cause of why this data has changed in this way. Look, there will be other limiting factors which haven't been impacted by the pandemic, the diversity of staff, the curriculum, and lots of other things. But tackling these awarding gaps, there's no silver bullet here. One of the factors may have been dealt with. We've got to see to what extent, and then keep working and chipping away at all the other things, as I said, towards diversity of the academy, the curriculum, the other aspects of the mode of delivery that might not have changed, to really make sure that we're understanding, student support, to really make sure we're taking the fullest view possible of the factors contributing to these gaps and what can be done to tackle them.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So, thanks very much to Amitai, Selena, Mike Ratcliffe, everyone at Team Wonky that makes it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.